chapter 16. I called this lesson, "Can This Be the End?" And that has multiple meanings, the first of which has to do with Mark chapter 16. If you look after verse 8, we have this note, at least in the NIV and in most modern translations, there's a similar note. It says, "The most reliable early manuscripts and other ancient witnesses do not have verses 9 through 20. So we're going to talk about that. Most of the time, we just pass over critical notes like this. We're going to park here and really go through it. I told Lewis earlier that I'm more a teacher than I am a preacher, and you're going to find out that's true. I just try to use the gift God gave me and not try to horn in on somebody else's gift, okay? So this is this has to do with that, and what this critical note is saying is that the most reliable early manuscripts and other ancient witnesses end Mark 16 with verse 8. And so that's why we have that title, "Can This Be the End?" Okay? At least in one sense. So we're going to talk about some other senses in a minute. But I call that a complex mystery. It's complex because there are several alternative endings to the Gospel of Mark. Okay. I do have to turn it on. Okay. So here's an overview of the different meanings of the end that we're talking about. The end of Mark's Gospel. We're going to talk about the end of Christianity and the end of evangelism. Okay? And it's the question, can this be the end? So first we're going to talk about the end of Mark's Gospel. And there are five rival endings to Mark's Gospel. Okay? The only two that we have in the Bible, at least the one I'm holding, it only has that ending that ends with verse 8 and then the one that ends with verses 9 through 20, but there are other endings as well. So I'm just going to go through those very quickly here. So this one that ends with verse 8, I'm calling the abrupt ending. It's very abrupt, okay? There's nothing past 16 verse 8. So the last words of the Gospel of Mark are, "And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid." And we're going to talk about whether that's an appropriate ending to the Gospel of Mark, and if so, how is it appropriate? Okay? So here's the Greek of that, kai ude, udeni, uden, epon, ephobunto, gar. Okay? Especially those last two words, ephobunto gar, for they were afraid. Okay? I'm going to use that sort of as an anchor as we go through looking at different manuscripts. Just watch for ephobunto gar, okay? Because that'll kind of orient you where these manuscripts are as far as their testimony. So as far as this ending is concerned, it's found in Codex Sinaiticus. It's called that because it was found at the Mount Sinai Monastery of St. Catherine. And it's also called Manuscript 1. The person who gave it that name happened to be the one who was ordering all the manuscripts. So it's given you an idea of his evaluation of that manuscript. He thought it should be number 1. But they had already been calling manuscripts A, B, C, D, E, so he gave it the designation Aleph to get it in front of A, okay? But anyway, you can see the end of Mark 16, verse 8 in the middle column here, and it leaves a big space before it goes to the Gospel of Luke in the right column, okay? If you want to see a close-up of what's going on here? There's the ephobunto gar. And then he's got these little marks, kind of like squiggles at the end of that line. And the whole next line has squiggles all the way across. What the scribe seems to be saying is, we are ending the Gospel of Mark here. Do you understand me? Not going any farther. Okay, so he's making it really plain. And he leaves some space before he starts with Luke, but he doesn't leave enough space to fill in verses 9 through 20. Okay, there's not enough space there. Now, Codex Vaticanus, which is a similar manuscript, you can see it also ends with 16 verse 8. He puts squiggles in, but not all the way across, but those squiggles are there. And he leaves an entire column and a little bit, and there might be enough space if you wrote small to get all those verses in, but the Gospel of Luke starts in the next on the next page, okay? So the alternative to that abrupt ending is what is called the longer ending, which in our Bibles is verses 9 through 20. So I'm just representing that by each one of those rectangles represents a verse, okay? So all of those verses are added to 16 verse 8. And the earliest manuscript we have for that is Codex Alexandrinus, which is the A of the ABC listing of the manuscripts. It was a little bit later than Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And you can see that that circle there represents where Efubonto Gar is. And 9 through 20 just starts immediately after with nothing in between, no squiggles, no nothing. Okay? And it just goes on from there. Now, we do have one manuscript that is earlier than any of these, which is the Chester Beatty Papyrus P45. The only problem is, in this part of Mark, it's only in fragments. So, you know, column by column, there's a little fragment here and a little fragment there. And we don't have anything for chapters 14 through 16 of the Gospel of Mark. It goes chapters 11 and 12, little fragments. And then sometime in Luke, it starts picking it up, and we have the whole manuscript for a lot of what's left. But in this part, it's missing. So we have to depend on Sinaiticus and Vaticanus and Alexandrinus for the manuscript evidence. Then there is a third alternative ending, which is which just adds one brief verse after 16 verse 8. It's not a verse that's in your Bible, unless you have a Bible that shows all of these alternatives. But that verse says this: but all that they had been told, they briefly reported to Peter and those who were with him. And after this, Jesus himself sent out by means of them from east to west the sacred and imperishable proclamation of eternal salvation. Okay? The earliest document we have that has this ending is Codex Bobbiensis. Doesn't have anything to do with Robert, okay? I don't know why it's called Bobbiensis, but this is a Old Latin manuscript. By Old Latin, we mean before the Vulgate, before Jerome's translation. And it's dated to the 400s. And that circle represents where the Efubonto Gar would be if it were in Greek, but it's in Latin. And then that additional verse in Latin is what follows. And you can see in the last line there, the word incorruptible. And then he ends with amen. Okay? So you've got 16, 1 through 8, and then this kind of summary verse following it. And then another ending of Mark is to take 16, 1 through 8, and then you add that imperishable proclamation verse, and then add the 16, add the rest of the verses 9 through 20 that we traditionally know. So it's kind of a combination. I call this the combo ending. And this is found in Codex Regius. It's called Regius because the King of France used to own this manuscript. And so the Efubonto Gar is right at the bottom of the first column there. Do you see it? Efubonto Gar? It's an upside down L and an A and a, looks like a P, but it's really an R. Efelbuntogar. And then it's got a bunch of squiggles, okay, all the way across. And then at the top, it has a critical note. And the critical note there says, some have this also. And then it has that one verse ending that is found in Babiensis. And then it has another critical note, and it says, this is there is also this appearing after Efelbuntogar, and then it has 9 through 20. Okay? So that's the next page is all the rest of 9 through 20. Okay? So this one is combining those two endings, giving you a choice of which ending you want. And here's another one. This is called the expansion ending. These are terms that I'm coming up with for what the different alternatives are. The expansion ending takes verses 9 through 20 and splits them in half at verse 14, okay, and then adds a paragraph that is not found anywhere else. It's not found in any other manuscript. And this is in Codex Washingtonius, the one that is I'm having trouble getting to. Okay, so you see the in the left side, you see the circle there? That is the Efelbuntogar. And the 16, 9 through 20 begins immediately following that. And it goes down to the point where it says the people didn't believe anyone who had told them that the resurrection was real. And before Jesus appeared and rebuked them for their lack of faith, a paragraph is added, and that paragraph is circled on the right side, okay? And here's what that paragraph says. They excuse themselves, saying, this age of lawlessness and unbelief is under Satan, and who does not allow what lies under the unclean spirits to understand the truth and power of God? Therefore, reveal your righteousness now. Thus they spoke to Christ, and Christ replied, the term of years of Satan's power has been fulfilled, but other terrible things draw near. And for those who have sinned, I was delivered over to death, that they may return to the truth and sin no more, in order that they may inherit the spiritual and incorruptible glory of righteousness which is in heaven. Now, scholars would kind of say this is a Gnostic paragraph, okay, that somebody has added. But Codex Washingtonius, why is it called that? Because it's now in Washington, D.C. You can go to the Freer Museum and look at this manuscript. I have. I've gone there and looked at it. But it's the only manuscript that has this paragraph. Okay, there isn't any other manuscript anywhere that has it. So these are the five alternatives. Okay, there's the abrupt ending. There's the brief ending, which adds one verse. There's the longer ending, which adds verses 9 through 20. Then there's the combo ending, which adds numbers 2 and 3. And then there's the expansion, which takes the longer ending and splits it in half and puts a paragraph in between that's probably Gnostic. Okay? So we're going to reject the ones that are easy to reject out of hand and look at the other two. Okay? We're going to look at the abrupt ending and the longer ending. Those are the ones who have at least an on-the-surface claim for being the original reading of the end of Mark. So let's look at the longer ending first. It's called the majority ending because 1,600 manuscripts have this ending. Two of them have the shorter ending as far as Greek manuscripts are concerned, and all the rest, or many of the rest, have this longer ending. Now, I say that, but I can also add that many of the ones that have it also have those little squiggly lines, you know, saying, the squiggly lines are a way of saying, just like our line across in our Bibles, of saying, we have some doubts about whether this is the original ending or not. But 1,600 manuscripts have the ending and many ancient versions. In favor of this ending, it's definitely a more fitting conclusion to the gospel as far as being satisfying to the reader. You know, we're wanting people to see Jesus and testify to his resurrection. And when you go to 16:1-8, They're told that Jesus has been raised, but nobody has seen him yet. And then they're told to go tell the disciples, and they start off to tell the disciples, but it says they say nothing to anyone because they're afraid. And you're kind of, everybody's leaning forward when that comes, when we get to the end of verse 8, wanting more to the story, okay? It ties up loose ends, kind of like this manuscript is tied up, and it proclaims the triumph of Christ in a more full way than the abrupt ending does. However, there are problems with this long ending. One of the problems is, we've already talked about, the earliest witnesses have the short ending. And another problem is internal, that when you get to the next verse, when you get to 16 verse 9, it's starting over in the story of the resurrection. Did you ever notice that? Like, if we could end chapter 15 and skip to 16:9 and watch how that works, okay? So Joseph bought some linen cloth, took down the body, wrapped it in linen, placed it in a tomb cut out of rock. Then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. And when Jesus rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, and so on. So as if 16:1 through 8 didn't even exist. But there's no manuscript that leaves out 16:1 through 8. Okay, so there's something going on where 9 through 20 is starting over, and it doesn't really fit what follows in 16:8. The second problem, which is a stronger argument, is what it does with Mary Magdalene. If you go back to chapter 15 and look at 15 verse 40, some women were watching from a distance, and among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. These women had followed him and cared for his needs. And then you skip to 15:47. Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of Joseph saw where he was laid. And then 16 verse 1, when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought the spices. Mary Magdalene has been introduced or talked about three times in a very short context here. So when we get to 16 verse 9, it says, when Jesus rose on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven seven demons. It's like whoever wrote that is introducing Mary all over again, as if she's a new character, you know. But this is the fourth time in just a few verses that she's been mentioned. That doesn't seem to fit. Also, the vocabulary is not Mark's. The style of writing is not Mark's. As you go through the Gospel of Mark, the basic difference between Mark and the other Gospels is that Mark is summarizing the teaching of Jesus, and he is elaborating on the narratives, the actions of Jesus. He's giving us a lot of details about what Jesus does, and he summarizes what Jesus says, okay? But in this section, 16:9 through 20, he does the opposite. He summarizes what Jesus does, and he elaborates on what Jesus says. So that seems to be against the style of what Mark is going on. And there's a whole bunch of words and phrases that are in this part of Mark, 16:9 through 20, that are not in the rest of the gospel. Okay, the way that he uses words, particular words that in the rest of Mark he uses synonyms for those words, but doesn't use those words that are not found there or found very seldom. Okay, plus this ending to Mark seems to be what scholars call a pastiche from other sources. Pastiche is not in my vocabulary, so I think the idea is it's a patchwork, okay, from a bunch of other sources. So this is a list of what those sources are, and the appearance to Mary in a couple of verses is in Luke the first 12 verses of chapter 24. The appearance on the road to Emmaus in a couple of verses is a big couple of paragraphs in Luke 24. The appearance to the disciples and so on. The Great Commission and the miracle catalog seems to come from outside the Gospels. And the ascension is similar to what is in Acts. And the signs that confirm is in Hebrews. So it seems to be drawing from all these other places in a very summary fashion to describe things that happen in the resurrection. In contrast to being part of the ongoing narrative of the Gospel of Mark. And then there is the signs section itself. Especially verses 17 and 18, it says, "These signs will accompany those who believe in my name. They will drive out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes with their hands. And when they drink deadly poison, it will not hurt them at all. They will place their hands on sick people and they will get well." One commentary I read said this about this section. Oh, by the way, it reminds us about the Church of the Lord Jesus in the Appalachians, where they actually take rattlesnakes as a sign of faith, and they play with them, and sometimes they get bit, and sometimes they die. And then they also mix up strychnine potions for people to drink, showing their faith that the Lord is going to keep them safe while they do that. It's based on this passage, okay? But one commentary says this: "Our Lord does not exempt himself or his disciples from the natural consequences of their acts. The very principle of his kingdom is that he and they shall take their place in the ordinary conditions of human life, and there shall be exposed not only to the ordinary dangers of that life, but to the extraordinary perils incident to a non-compromising righteousness in an evil world, and without any miraculous safeguards." And here that miraculous safeguarding is promised as the condition distinctly supplanting the ordinary. So another way of saying this is, everywhere else in the Gospel and in the rest of the New Testament, the Lord is telling people, you have to be faithful to Christ no matter what happens. And there will be times when you are killed. There will be times when you'll be persecuted. You're going to be chased from town to town. And if they catch you, they're going to beat you. And we could go on through all the different lists of things that are done to Christians for their faith. But that's in contrast to what Jesus is saying in this passage, where he says, If you get bitten by a poisonous snake, you'll be okay, and you can drink poison, and it'll be fine. Very strong contrast between those two, okay? And yes, there was that one occasion when Paul was gathering sticks on a rainy night after being shipwrecked, and a viper came out of the fire and bit him. And he was not harmed at all, and people thought he must be a god, but they finally concluded that he was one of God's messengers. But to make that a promise to everyone is what we're talking about. Seems to be foreign to the rest of the New Testament. Okay, so we have problems with the longer ending. What about the abrupt ending? Well, the abrupt ending is the earliest alternative. It's supported by those two early and best manuscripts. It also has the support of some of the earliest translations of the New Testament, including the Sinaitic Syriac, which is the earliest translation of the New Testament. And this is a translation of the translation. Okay, this is the English version of what that Syriac says, and you can see it ends with the phrase, "For they were afraid." It ends with verse 8, just like Codex Sinaiticus and Vaticanus end. There was an early awareness of this alternative, even by those who went ahead and put the rest of verses 9 through 20 because of their squiggly marks. And there is additional support beyond these. For example, Eusebius of Caesarea, in talking about a supposed discrepancy between the Gospels about the timing of the resurrection, says to Marinus, "It is not found in all the copies of the Gospel according to Mark," that is verses 9 through 20, "accurate copies and their text of the Markan account end with, 'because they were frightened.' This is where the text does end in almost all copies of the Gospel according to Mark. What occasionally follow in some copies, not all, would be extraneous, most particularly if it contains something contradictory to the evidence of the other evangelists." Okay, this guy lived in the 300s, and he says, "In my time, most and the best didn't have anything past 16:8. Also, what's called the Eusebian canons end at 16:8. What are the Eusebian canons? I'm glad you asked that question. Okay. In the margins of the manuscripts of the New Testament, Eusebius came up with a system of numbering each paragraph. So at the Gospel of Matthew, the first paragraph in the Gospel of Matthew has the number 1, and then the next one is 2, and so on, all the way through the Gospel of Matthew. When he gets to Mark, he gives it the next paragraph in sequence, goes all the way through the Gospel of Mark to number 233, that's the last paragraph in Mark, and then Luke is 234, and so on, and then John. And what you have in the Eusebian canons are lists of parallel passages, okay? So paragraph, whatever it is in Matthew, paragraph 1, in Luke, it would be paragraph 100 and whatever it is, 160. And in John, so those numbers are put in tables. So what you have here is from a manuscript, the left page is giving you all of the paragraphs that are found in all four Gospels that are parallel to each other. The one on the right is where they are found in three of the Gospels, but not the fourth. And it continues with other tables that show where they are found in 2 out of 4, and which two. You know, Matthew and Mark, it's a short table. Matthew and Luke, Mark and Luke, Luke and John, Matthew and John, Mark and John. And then he has a long table where it's found only in one of the Gospels, okay? So those are called the Eusebian canons. And what we find as far as the ending of Mark is the canon numbers assigned to the paragraphs end at 16:8. There is no numbering of verses 9 through 20. Even in manuscripts that have Eusebian canon numbers assigned to them, there are no numbers for those paragraphs. And that's a pretty good evidence that whoever made the canon, Eusebius, did not believe that they were part of the original text. But there are problems with the abrupt ending, and one problem is that it ends with a conjunction, for. I'm not going to get into all the details of this except to say that in Greek, conjunctions sometimes come in a position in the in the sequence of words in a sentence that's later than what it would be in the translation. And so this ends with gar, which is a conjunction. Normally what would come after it is for, they were afraid in English, but they were afraid comes before the gar, and then it ends with the word gar. So some say it's like that conjunction is dangling in the wind at the end of the Gospel of Mark. And people have said there's no other ancient book that has gar as its last word. However, some scholars have found it in very recent times. Anyway, a bigger problem is that it's too abrupt. It's very unsettling. It leaves not just the conjunction flapping in the wind, but it leaves all of us feeling that way. It sort of leaves us hanging. And there are two explanations. One explanation is that the last page of the Gospel of Mark might have been lost accidentally. because they used to be written in what's called a codex, so that leaves of papyrus are folded and sewn together, and then the last page of that leaf might have broken off and just been lost. If that is the explanation, it happened very early in the transmission of the Gospel of Mark. And that happens from time to time. You can see this copy, some of the first page is starting to break off in the bottom right corner. The whole page might at some point break off. Another explanation is that this is how Mark intended for the gospel to end. We're going to pursue that in a minute. But the question that immediately arises is, what could he have been thinking to end the gospel this way? For the women to leave the tomb with the report from the angels that Jesus is risen, and then trembling, not say anything to anyone because they were afraid. Okay? So that's what we're going to look at right now is why Mark might have written that. And we have to go back to Mark the author and deal with what may have been in Mark's mind. You know, is this going to be the end of Christianity because of our situation? Let me give you a little background about Mark. All of these church fathers and other testimony from the second century are telling us about Mark, and they all say the same thing, which is basically that Mark was the interpreter for Peter, and that Peter would preach and Mark would write it down, and Mark is writing down the things that Peter said and got them in some kind of order, but it's not necessarily chronological order, and he just made sure that he didn't omit anything Peter said, and that everything that he wrote down was accurate, okay? So the time of Mark's writing is probably after Peter's death. Peter's been preaching, and there is a fire in Rome in the summer of 64. And during the persecution that followed, when Nero pinned the fire cause on the Christians, the persecution that followed resulted in the martyrdom of both Peter and Paul. So now Peter is gone, and he can't give that oral witness anymore to the resurrection or to the teachings and life of Christ. So with him out of the way and dead, Mark has been badgered, is the word I can think of, by other Christians to publish what Peter had preached about the sayings of Jesus. So what Mark creates in his gospel is kind of a "you were there" kind of a narrative, so that his idea is to put his readers into the place of those early followers of Jesus, to experience the things that they experienced, and to help them have a growing awareness of who Jesus is, to the point where they are enlightened, just like the blind man, you know, who at first could only see men like trees walking around, and then more contact with Jesus brought him to a fuller sight. That's a symbol, or seems to be a symbol, for what was going on with everyone who reads the Gospel of Mark, to the point where they become committed disciples, okay? But then he gets to the end, which is the climax of this story, which you expect, all of us expect, to be a triumphant revelation of the risen Jesus. And instead, he gives this broken off narrative, and he says, the women left the tomb frightened, not saying anything to anyone because they were afraid. Here's what one commentator says about that ending. He says, Mark apparently wanted an open ending to indicate the story was not complete, but was continuing beyond the time he wrote. He wanted his readers and hearers to continue the story in their own lives, he challenged his readers and hearers to assume the responsibility of telling the good news to everyone. In other words, Mark is putting you in the shoes or the sandals of those women who went to the tomb. They hear this message. They have not seen the risen Jesus, but they hear the message that he arose. And now they're leaving the tomb, and they're given the commission to tell other people what they've seen and heard, or what they've heard, that Jesus is raised. And is their reaction to that going to be the same as the women? They're intimidated by Nero. There's this persecution going on, and Tacitus tells us that it was a terrible persecution, okay? Nero even went to the point of crucifying hundreds of people and putting, when he crucified Peter, he put him upside down. He dipped people in tar and lit them afire to light his gardens at night. And people could be afraid, and imagine them in the catacombs. You know, I have a picture here somewhere. They're in the catacombs talking about Jesus among themselves, but they're afraid to tell anybody else because of this persecution going on. You know, if you talk about Jesus, it's possible you're going to be killed. So is this the end of Christianity? You know, that was a distinct possibility at the time this persecution was so great. But what is Mark really telling them? He's telling them, you know, you need to go beyond your fear and tell people the good news about the resurrection, okay? What would have happened if the Christians of Rome had not continued to evangelize? You know, if they just kept it in the catacombs and never told anybody else about it, it might have spelled the end of Christianity, or at least in Rome, there would have been a long period where nobody in Rome was Christian. In contrast to what really happened, they continued to tell the good news in spite of their fear. They overcame that fear and continued to tell. And eventually Rome itself was converted to Christianity. And the number of Christians in the capital of the empire became overwhelmingly the majority group. Okay, so that brings us down to the third question, which is, what about today? The end of evangelism? Can this be the end of evangelism because we're afraid? Are we intimidated? Are we encouraged? Read 16:1-8 and put yourself in their position. The messengers, the angels have told you about the resurrection. You know about Jesus and the things that he said and did. Are you going to let the good news stop with you? Is fear going to stop you from sharing the good news of Jesus? We're going to sing a song, Stand Up for Jesus, to encourage one another about this. If you want the prayers of this congregation, or if you want today to become a Christian, to put on your Lord in baptism, we invite you to make that public as we stand and sing.
He's